want to do something, dammit! She held out the cloak with a wavering arm. Thrace crawled over and took it. She held it up, looking at it, as if she were in the comfort of a dressing room.
It's very beautiful. So heavy.
Again Arista laughed, thinking how strange it was to fly from despair to laughter in a single breath. One of them was surely insane. Maybe they both were. Arista wrapped it around the young girl as she clasped it on. And here I was, ready to kill Bernice. Arista thought of Hilfred and the maid left, no, ordered to stay in the room. Had she killed them?
Do you think anyone survived?
The girl rolled aside a statue's head and what looked like a broken marble tabletop.
My father is alive, Thrace said simply, digging deeper.
Arista didn't ask how she knew this, but believed her. At that moment, she would believe anything Thrace told her. With a nice hole dug into the heart of the debris, Thrace had yet to find a weapon beyond a leg bone, which she set aside with grisly indifference to use in case she found nothing better, Arista guessed. The princess watched the excavation with a mix of admiration and disbelief. Thrace uncovered a beautiful mirror that was shattered, and struggled to free a jagged piece, when Arista saw a glint of gold and pointed, saying, "There's something under the mirror." Thrace pushed the glass aside and, reaching down, grabbed hold and drew forth the hilt half of a broken sword. Elaborately decorated in silver and gold, encrusted with fine, sparkling gems, the pommel caught the starlight and sparkled. Thrace took the sword by the grip and held it up.
"It's light," she said.
"It's broken," Arista replied. "But I suppose it's better than a piece of glass." Thrace stowed the hilt in the lining pocket of the cloak and went on digging. She came across the head of an axe and a fork, both of which she discarded. Then, pulling back a bit of cloth, she stopped suddenly. Arista hated to look, but once more felt compelled. It was a woman's face, eyes closed, mouth open. Thrace placed the cloth back over the hole she had made. She retreated to the far edge and sat down, squeezing her knees while resting her head. Arista could see her shaking, and Thrace didn't dig any more after that. The two sat in silence. Thrump, thrump. Arista heard the sound, and her heart raced. Every muscle in her body tightened, and she dared not look. A great gust of air struck from above as she closed her eyes. She heard it land, and waited to die. Arista could hear it breathing, and still she waited.
"Soon," she heard it say.
Arista opened her eyes. The beast rested on the pile, panting from the effort of its flight. It shook its head, spraying the platform with loose saliva from its lips, which failed to hide the forest of jagged teeth. Its eyes were larger than Arista's hand, with tall, narrow pupils on a marbled orange and brown lens that reflected her own image.
"Soon?"
She didn't know where she found the courage to speak. The massive eye blinked, and the pupil dilated as it focused on her. It would kill her now, but at least it would be over.
"Thou knowest my speech."
The voice was large, and so deep she felt it vibrating in her chest. She both nodded and said, "Yes." Across from her, the princess could see Thrace with her head up off her knees, staring. The beast looked at Arista.
"Thou art regal."
"I am a princess."
"The best bait,"
the Galarabrin said. But Arista was not sure she heard that right. It might also have said, "the greatest gift."
The phrase was difficult to translate. She asked,
"Wilt thou honour thy trade or kill us?"
"The bait stays alive until I catch the thief."
"Thief?"
"The taker of the sword. It comes. I crossed the moon to deceive it that the way it was clear, and I have returned flying low. The thief comes now."
"What's it saying?"
Thrace asked. "It said we are bait to catch a thief that stole a sword."
"Royce,"
Thrace said. Arista stared at her.
"What did you say?"
"I hired two men to steal a sword from this tower."
"You hired Royce Melbourne and Hadrian Blackwater?"
Arista asked, stunned.
"Yes. How did you—"
She gave that thought up. "It knows Royce is coming," Arista told her. "It pretended to fly away, letting him see it leave." The Galara Bryn's ears perked up, suddenly tilting forward toward the false door. Abruptly, but quietly, it stood and, with a gentle flap of its wings, lifted off. Catching the thermals, the beast soared upward above the tower. Thrace and Arista heard movement somewhere below, footsteps on stone. A figure appeared, in a black cloak. It stepped forward, passing through the solid stone of the false door, like a man surfacing from below a still pond.
"It's a trap, Royce!"
Arista and Thrace shouted together. The figure did not move. Arista heard the whispered sound of air rushing across leathery wings. Then a brilliant light abruptly burst forth from the figure. Without a sound or movement, it was as if a star appeared in place of the man, the light so bright it blinded everyone. Arista closed her eyes in pain and heard the Galara Bryn screech overhead. She felt frantic puffs of air beat down on her as the beast flapped its wings, breaking its dive. The light was short-lived. It faded abruptly, though not entirely, and soon they could all see the man in the shimmering robe before them.
"You!"
The beast cursed at him, shaking the tower with its voice. It hovered above them, its great wings flapping. "Escaped thy cage, beast of Erevan, hunter of Nerion," Esrahaddon shouted in old speech. "I shall cage thee again." The wizard raised his arms, but before he made another move, the Galara Bryn screeched and fluttered back in horror. It beat its great wings and rose, but in that last second it reached down with one talon, snatching Thrace off the tower. It dove over the side, vanishing from sight. Arista raced to the railing, looking down in horror. The beast and Thrace were gone.
"We can do nothing for her,"
the wizard said sadly. She turned to see Esrahaddon and Royce Melbourne beside her, both looking over the edge into the dark roar of the river below. Her fate lies with Hadrian and her father now. Arista's hands squeezed the railing stiffly. She felt the drowning sensation again. Royce grabbed her by the wrist.
"Are you all right, Your Highness? It's a long way down, you know."
"Let's get her downstairs," Esrahaddon said. "The door, Royce. The door."
"Oh, right," the thief replied.
"Grant entry to Arista Essendon, Princess of Melengar."
The archway became a real door that stood open. They all entered a small room. Off the pile, safe behind walls, Arista felt the impact at last, and she was forced to sit before she fell. She buried her face in her hands and wailed,
"Oh, God, dear Maribor, poor Thrace!"
"She may yet be all right," the wizard told her. "Hadrian and her father are waiting with the broken sword." She rocked as she cried, but she did not cry only for Thrace. The tears were the bursting of a dam that could resist the flood no longer.
In her mind flashed images of Hilfred and that last unspoken word, of Bernice and the cruel way she had treated her, and of Fanon and Marvin, all of them lost. So much sorrow couldn't be put into words. Instead, the emotions exploded out of her as she shouted, "The sword? What sword? What is all of this about a sword? I don't understand!"
"You explain," Royce said. "I need to find the other half."
"It's not there," Arista told him.
"What?"
"You said the sword was broken?" Arista asked.
"In two parts. I stole the blade half yesterday. Now I need to get the hilt half. I'm pretty certain it's in that pile up there."
"No, it isn't," Arista said, shocked that her brain was still working enough to connect the dots. "Not anymore."
The wizard led the way down the long crystalline steps, pausing from time to time to peer down a corridor or at a staircase. He would think for a moment, then shake his head and push on, or mutter, "Ah, yes," and turn.
"Where are we?" she asked.
"Arvempartha," the wizard replied.
"I got that much already. What is Arvempartha? And don't say it's a tower."
"It is an elven construction, built several millennia ago. More recently it has been a trap that has held the Gilarabrin. And, more recently still, it has apparently been its nest. Does that help?"
"Not really."
Although perplexed, Arista did feel better. It surprised her how easy it was to forget. It felt wrong. She should be thinking about the ones lost. She should be grieving. But her mind fought against it. Like broken limbs that refused to support any more weight, her heart and mind were hungry for relief. She needed a rest. Something else to think about. Something that didn't involve death and misery. The Tower of Arvempartha provided that remedy. It was astounding. Ezra Harden led them up and down stairs, through great rooms, and across interior bridges that spanned between spire shafts. Not a torch or lantern burned, but she could see perfectly, the walls themselves giving off a soft blue light. Vaulted ceilings 100 feet high spread out like the canopy of a forest, with intricately lined designs that suggested branches and leaves. Railings appearing as curling tendrils of creeping vines, sculpted from solid stone in vivid detail, ran along walkways and down steps. Nothing was without adornment, every inch imbued with beauty and care. Arista walked with her mouth open, her eyes shifting from one wonder to the next. A giant statue of a magnificent swan taking flight, a bubbling fountain in the shape of a school of fish. She recalled the crude barbarity of King Roswert's castle and his disdain for the elves, beings he likened to rats in a woodpile. Some woodpile. There was a music to this place. The muted humming of the falls created a low, comforting bass. The wind across the tips of the tower played as woodwinds in an orchestra, soft, reassuring tones. The bubbling and trickling of fountains lent light, satisfying rhythms to the symphony. Into this harmony crashed the voice of Ezra Harden as he recounted his first visit to the tower centuries before, and how he had trapped the beast inside.
"So, since you trapped the Gilarabrin 900 years ago," she said, "you plan to trap it here again?"
"No," Ezra Harden told her. "No hands, remember? I can't cast that powerful of a binding spell without fingers, girl. You should know that better than anyone."
"I heard you threaten to cage it again."
"The Gilarabrin doesn't know Ezra doesn't have hands, does it?" Royce put in.
"The beast remembered me," the wizard said, taking over. "It assumed I was just as powerful as before, which means, aside from the sword,
I am about the only thing the Galarabran fears.
You just wanted to scare it off?
That was the idea, yes.
We were trying to get the sword and hoped we might also save the both of you in the process, Royce told her. I obviously didn't expect her to grab Thrace, and there was absolutely no way I could have guessed she would have taken the sword with her.
You're certain she took a sword hilt from the pile?
Yes. I was the one who spotted it. But I still don't understand. How does the sword help? The Galarabran isn't an enchantment. It's a monster that the heir must kill, and...
You've been listening to the church. The Galarabran is a magical creation. The sword is the countermeasure.
A sword is? That doesn't make sense. A sword is metal, a physical element.
Ezra Hardin smiled, looking a bit surprised. So you paid attention to my lessons.
Excellent.
You're right. The sword is worthless. It is the word written on the blade that has the power to dispel the conjuration. If it is plunged into the body of the beast, it will unlock the elements holding it in existence and break the enchantment.
If only you had been the one to take it, we'd have a way to fight the thing.
Well, you did save me, at least,
Arista reminded them.
Thank you.
Don't thank us too soon. It's still out there, Royce told her.
Okay, so Thrace hired Royce. I don't know how that transpired, but okay. Still, I don't understand why you're here, Ezra, she admitted.
To find the heir.
There isn't an heir, she told them. All the contestants failed, and the rest are dead, I'm sure. That monster destroyed everything.
I'm not talking about that foolishness. I'm speaking about the real heir of Novron.
The wizard came to a T-intersection and turned left, heading for a staircase that led down again.
Wait a minute, Royce stopped them. We didn't come this way.
No, we didn't, but I did.
Royce looked around him.
No, this is all wrong. Here I was letting you lead, and you clearly don't have a clue where the exit is.
I'm not leading you to the exit.
What?
Royce asked.
We're not leaving, the wizard replied. I am going to the Valentrin Leartrin, and the two of you are coming with me.
You might want to explain why, Royce told him, his voice chilling several degrees. Otherwise you are jumping to a pretty big conclusion.
I'll explain on the way.
Explain now, Royce told him. I have other appointments to consider.
You can't help, Hadrian, the wizard said. The Galarabran is already at the village by now. Hadrian is either dead or safe. Nothing you can do will change that. You can't help him, but you can help me. I spent the better part of 2 days trying to access the Valentrin Leartrin, but without your hands, Royce, I can't reach it, and it would take days, perhaps weeks, for me to operate alone. But with Arista here, we can do it all tonight. Maribor has seen fit to deliver both of you to me at the precise moment I need you most.
Valentrin Leartrin, Royce muttered. That's Elvish for artistic vision, isn't it?
You know some Elvish. Good for you, Royce,
Ezra Hardin said. You should pursue your roots more.
Your roots?
Arista said, confused.
They both ignored her.
You can't help the people back at the village, but you can help me do what I came here to do. What I brought you here to help me with.
You need us to help you find the true heir of the Empire.
You're normally quicker than this, Royce. I'm disappointed.
I thought you were keeping it a secret.
I was, but circumstances have forced me to reconsider. Now quit being so stubborn and come with me. You might look back on this moment one day and reflect on how you changed the course of the world by simply walking down these steps.
Royce continued to hesitate.
Think, Esrahaddon said. What can you do for Hadrian?
Royce didn't answer.
If you run down the steps, race through the tunnel, swim out to the woods and kill yourself running to the village, what will that accomplish? Even if you miraculously manage to reach the town before Hadrian is killed, how will that help? You'll be standing there exhausted and dripping wet. You don't have the sword. You can't harm it. You can't scare it. I doubt you can even distract it, and if you do, it will only be for a moment. If you go, it will only be to your own death, and for no reason at all. Hadrian's fate does not lie in your hands. You know I'm right, or you wouldn't be listening to me. Now, stop being stubborn.
Royce sighed.
Thank the gods, the wizard said. Let's get moving.
Wait a minute, Arista stopped them. Don't I get a say in this too?
The wizard looked back at her. Do you know the way out?
No, she replied.
Then no, you don't get a say, the wizard told her. Now please, we've wasted enough time. Follow me.
I remember you being nicer, Arista shouted at the wizard.
And I remember both of you being faster. They were off again, heading deeper into the center of the tower. As they did, Esrahaddon spoke again. Most people believe this tower was built by the elves as a defensive fortress for the wars against Novron. As both of you most likely have guessed, that's not true. This tower predates Novron by many millennia. Others think it was built as a fortress against the sea goblins, the infamous Baran Gazelle. Only that's also not true, since the tower predates their appearance as well. The common mistake here is that this is a fortress at all. That's the result of human thinking. The fact is, the elves lived for eons before man or goblin, and perhaps even before dwarves entered the world. In those days they had no need for fortresses. They didn't even have a word for war, as the Horn of Glyndora controlled all of their internal strife. No, this wasn't some defensive bulwark guarding the only crossing point on the Nidwalden River, although that certainly became its use many eons later. Originally, this tower was designed as a center for the art.
He means magic, Arista clarified.
I know what he means. Elven masters would travel here from the world over to study and practice advanced art. Still, this wasn't just a school. The building itself is an enormous tool, like a giant furnace for a blacksmith, only in this case, the building works as a focusing element. The falls function as a source of power, and the tower's numerous spires are like the antennae on a grasshopper or the whiskers of a cat. They reach out into the world, sensing, feeling, drawing into this place the very essence of existence. It is like a giant lever and fulcrum, allowing a single artist to magnify their power almost beyond reason.
Artistic vision, Royce said. It's a device that will allow you to use magic to find the air.
Sadly, not even Avampartha has that much power. I can't find something I've never seen or something I don't know exists. What I can do, however, is find something I do know, something that I am very well acquainted with, and something I created for the specific purpose of finding later.
900 years ago, when Jerish and I decided to split up in order to hide Nevrig, I made amulets for them. These amulets served two purposes. One was to protect them from the art, thus preventing anyone from locating them by divination. The other was to provide me with a means to track them with a signature only I know how to recognize.
Of course, Cherish and I assumed it would only take a few years to assemble a group of loyalists to restore the Emperor. But as we all now know, that didn't happen. I can only hope that Cherish was smart enough to impress upon the descendants of the heir to keep the necklaces safe, and to hand them down from one generation to the next. That might be asking too much, since... Well, who could imagine that I would live so long? They crossed another narrow bridge, which spanned a disturbingly deep gap. Overhead were several colourful banners, with iconic images embroidered on them with large, single elven letters. Ariston noticed Royce staring at them, his mouth working as if he was trying to read. On the far side of the bridge, they reached a doorstep, where a tall, ornately decorated archway was drawn into the stone, but no door was present. "Royce, if you wouldn't mind..." Royce stepped forward and, laying his hand on the polished stone, pressed. "What's he doing?" Arista asked the wizard. Ezra Hardin turned and looked at Royce. The thief stood before them uncomfortably for a moment, then said, "Avampartha has a magical protection that prevents anyone who doesn't have elvish blood from entering. Every lock in the place works the same way. Originally we thought no one else but I could enter. Oh, and Ezra, because he had been invited years ago. But it turns out that if an elf invites you, that's all that is needed. Ezra found the exact elvish wording for me to memorize for the invite. That's how I got you in." "Speaking of which..." Ezra Hardin motioned toward the stone arch. "Sorry," Royce said, and added in a clear voice, "Melantonaria en Vina Renden Ezra Hardin, en Arista Essendon Adona Melangar," which Arista understood as, "Grant entry to the wizard Ezra Hardin and Arista Essendon, Princess of Melangar." "That's old speech," Arista said. "Yes," Ezra Hardin nodded. "There are many similarities between Elvish and Old Imperial." "Whoa!" Looking back at the archway, Arista suddenly saw an open door. "But I still don't understand. How is it you can grant us..." "Oh." The princess stopped with her mouth still open. "But you don't look at all..."
"I'm a mere."
"What?"
"A mix," Ezra Hardin explained. "Some elven, some human blood."
"But you never..."
"It's not the kind of thing you brag about," the thief said. "And I'd appreciate it if you kept this to yourself."
"Oh, of course."
"Come along. Arista still needs to play her part," Ezra Hardin said, entering.
Inside, they found a large chamber carved perfectly round. It was like entering the inside of a giant ball. Unlike the rest of the tower, and despite its size, the room was unadorned. It was merely a vast, smooth chamber with no seam, crack, nor crevice. The only feature was a zigzagging stone staircase that rose from the floor to a platform that extended out from the steps and stood at the exact center of the sphere. "Do you remember the Plesiantic incantations I taught you, Arista?" the wizard asked as they climbed the stairs, his voice echoing loudly, ricocheting repeatedly off the walls. "Do you or don't you?"
"I'm thinking."
"Think faster. This is no time for slow wits."
"Yes, I remember. Lord, but you've gotten testy."
"I'll apologize later. Now, when we get up there, you are going to stand in the middle of the platform on the mark laid out on the floor as the apex. You will begin and maintain the Plesiantic phrase. Start with a gathering incantation. When you do, you will likely feel a bit more of a jolt than you would normally, because this place will amplify your power to gather resources. Don't be alarmed. Don't stop the incantation. And whatever you do, don't scream."
Arista looked fearfully back at Royce.
Once you feel the power moving through your body, begin the Torsonic chant. As you do, you will need to form the crystal matrix with your fingers, making certain you fold inward, not outward.
So, with my thumbs pointing out and the rest of my fingers pointing at me, right?
Yes, Ezra Hardin said, irritated. This is all basic formations, Arista.
I know it. I know it. It's just been a while. I've been busy being Melengar's ambassador, not sitting in my tower practicing conjurations.
So you've been frivolously wasting your time?
No, she said, exasperated.
Now, when you've completed the matrix, the wizard went on, just hold it. Remember the concentration techniques I taught you, and focus on keeping the matrix even and steady. At that point, I'll tap into your power field and conduct my search. When I do, this room is likely to do some extraordinary things. Images and visions will become visible at various places in the room, and you might even hear sounds. Again, don't be alarmed. They aren't really here. They will merely be echoes of my mind as I search for the amulets.
Does that mean all of us will be able to see who the real heir is?
Royce asked as they reached the top.
Ezra Hardin nodded. I would have liked to have kept it to myself, but fate has seen fit to force me a different way. When I find the magical pulse of the amulets, I'll focus on the owners, and they will likely appear as the largest image in the room, as I'll be concentrating to determine not only who wears them, but where they are as well. The platform was only faintly dust-covered, and they could easily see the massive converging geometric lines marked on the floor like rays of the sun, all gathering to a single point in the exact center of the dais.
Them? Arista asked, as she took her position at the central point.
There are two necklaces. One I gave to Navrik, which will be the heir's amulet, and the other to Jerish, which will be the bodyguard's. If they still exist, we should see both. I would ask that you not tell anyone what you are about to see, for if you do, you could put the heir's life in immense danger, and possibly imperil the future of mankind as we know it.
Wizards and their drama.
Royce rolled his eyes. A simple, please keep your mouth shut would do. Ezra Hardin raised an eyebrow at the thief, then turned to Arista and said, begin.
Arista hesitated. Solly had to be wrong. All that talk about the heir having the power to enslave mankind was just to frighten her into being their spy. His warnings that Ezra Hardin was a demon must be more lies. He was secretive, certainly, but not evil. He had saved her life that night. What had Solly done? How many days before Braga's death had Saldo known and done nothing? Too many.
Arista, Ezra Hardin pressed. She nodded, raised her hands, and began the weave.
Chapter 14. As Darkness Falls. The night wind blew gently across the hilltop. Hadrian and Theron stood alone on the ruins of the manor, above what had been a village, a place of countless hopes that lay buried in ash and wreckage. Theron felt the breeze on his skin and remembered the ill wind he had felt the night his family died. The night Thrace ran to him. He could still see her as she raced down the slope of Stony Hill, running to the safety of his arms. He had thought that was the worst day of his life. He had cursed his daughter for coming to him. He had blamed her for the death of his family. He had put on her all the woe and despair that he had been too weak to carry. She was his little girl, the one who always walked beside him wherever he went. And when he shooed her away, as he always did, he would catch her following at a distance, watching him, mimicking his actions and his words. Thrace was the only one who laughed at his faces, cried when he was hurt,
the one who sat at his bedside when he lay with fever. He had never had a good word for his daughter, never a pat or praise that he could remember. Not once did he ever say he was proud of her. Most of the time, he hadn't acknowledged her at all. But he would gladly give his own life, merely to see his little girl run to him again. Just once more. Theron stood shoulder to shoulder with Hadrian. He held the broken blade hidden beneath his clothes, ready to draw it out in an instant to appease the beast if needed. Hadrian held the false blade the dwarf had fashioned, and he, too, kept it hidden, explaining that if the Gilarabrin knew in advance where its prize was, it might not bother with the trade. Magnus and Tobias waited down the hill, out of sight behind a hunting blind of assembled wreckage, while Thomas worked at making Hilfred and Morven as comfortable as possible at the bottom of the hill. The moon had risen and climbed above the trees, and still the beast had not come. The torches Hadrian had lit in a circle around the hilltop were burning out. Only a few remained, but it didn't seem to matter, as the moon was bright, and with the canopy of leaves gone, they could see well enough to read a book. "Maybe it's not coming," Thomas said to them, climbing up the hill. "Maybe it wasn't supposed to be tonight, or maybe I was just hearing things. I've never been very good with the old speech." "How's Morven?" Hadrian asked. "The bleeding stopped. He's sleeping peacefully now. I covered him with a blanket and created a pillow for him from a spare shirt. He and the soldier Hilfred should—" There came a cry from the tower that turned their heads. To his amazement, Theron saw a brilliant explosion of white light flare at the pinnacle of the tower. It was there one moment, and then faded as suddenly as it had appeared.
"What in the name of Maribor was that?" Theron asked.
Hadrian shook his head.
"I don't know. But if I had to guess, I'd say Royce had something to do with it."
There was another cry from the Gilarabrin, this one louder.
"Whatever it was," Hadrian told him, "I think it's headed our way."
Behind them, they could faintly hear Thomas praying.
"Put in a good word for Thrace, Thomas," Theron told him.
"I'm putting a word in for all of us," the cleric replied.
"Hadrian," Theron said, "if by chance I don't survive this and you do, keep an eye on my Thrace for me, will you? And if she dies too, see to it we're buried on my farm."
"And if I should die, and you live," Hadrian said, "make sure this dagger I have in my belt gets back to Royce before the dwarf steals it."
"Is that all?" the farmer asked. "Where do you want us to bury you?"
"I don't want to be buried," he said. "If I die, I think I'd like my body to be sent down the river, over the falls. Who knows? I might make it all the way to the sea."
"Good luck," Theron told him.
The sounds of night fell silent, save only for the breath of the wind. This time, with no forest in the way, Theron could see it coming. Its wide, dark wings stretched out like the shadow of a soaring bird, its thin body curling, its tail snapping as it flew. It didn't dive as it approached. It didn't breathe fire or land. Instead, it circled in silent flight, arcing in a wide ellipse. As it circled, they could see it wasn't alone. Within its claws it held a woman. At first, Theron couldn't tell who it was. She appeared to be wearing a richly tailored robe, but she had Thrace's sandy-colored hair. As it circled the second time, he knew it was his daughter. A wave of relief and heightened anxiety gripped him.
"What has become of the other?"
After several circles, the beast lowered like a kite and softly touched the ground. It landed directly in front of them, not more than 50 feet away, on the site of the now collapsed manor house. Thrace was alive. A massive claw of scale-covered muscle and bone, tipped with 4-foot-long black nails, surrounded her like a cage.
"Daddy!"
she cried in tears. Seeing her, Theron made a lunge forward. Instantly, the Gilarabrin's claw tightened and she cried out. Hadrian grabbed Theron and pulled him back.
"Wait!" he shouted. "It'll kill her if you get too close."
The beast glared at them with huge reptilian eyes. Then the Gilarabrin spoke. Neither Theron nor Hadrian understood a word.
"Thomas!" Hadrian shouted over his shoulder. "What's it saying?"
"I'm not very good at..." Thomas began.
"I don't care how well you did in grammar at seminary, just translate."
"I think it said it chose to take the females because it would create the greatest incentive for cooperation."
The creature spoke again, and Thomas didn't wait for Hadrian to tell him to translate.
"It says, where is the blade that was stolen?"
Hadrian looked back at Thomas.
"Ask it, where is the other female?"
Thomas spoke, and the beast replied.
"It says the other escaped."
"Ask it, how do I know you'll let us all live if I tell you where the blade is hidden?"
Thomas spoke, and the beast replied again.
"It says it will offer you a gesture of good faith, since it knows it has the upper hand and understands your concern."
It opened its claw, and Thrace ran to her father. Theron's heart leapt as his little girl raced across the hill to his waiting arms. He hugged her tight and wiped away her tears.
"Theron," Hadrian said, "get her out of here. Both of you, get back to the well if you can."
Theron and his daughter didn't argue, and the Gilarabrin's great eyes watched carefully as Theron and Thrace began to sprint down the hill. Then it spoke again.
"Now, where is the blade?"
Thomas translated. Looking up at the towering beast and feeling the sweat dripping down his face, Hadrian drew the false blade out of his sleeve and held it up. The Gilarabrin's eyes narrowed.
"Bring it to me,"
Thomas translated its words. This was it. Hadrian felt the metal in his hands.
"Please let this work," he whispered to himself, and tossed the blade.
It landed in the ash before the beast. The Gilarabrin looked down at it, and Hadrian held his breath. The beast casually placed its foot upon the blade and gathered it into its long talons. Then it looked at Hadrian and spoke.
"The deal is complete," Thomas said, "but..."
"But?"
Hadrian repeated nervously.
"But what?"
Thomas's voice grew weak.
"But it says, I cannot allow those who have seen even half my name to remain alive."
"Oh, you bastard!" Hadrian cursed, pulling his great spadone sword from his back. "Run, Thomas!"
The Gilarabrin rose, flapping its great wings, causing a storm of ash to swirl into a cloud. It snapped forward with its head like a snake. Hadrian dove aside and, spinning, drove his sword at the beast. Rather than feeling the blade tip penetrate, however, Hadrian felt his heart sink as the point of the spadone skipped off as if the Gilarabrin were made of stone. The sudden shock broke his grip, and the sword fell. Not losing a beat, the Gilarabrin swung its tail around in a sharp snap. The long bone blade on the tip hummed as it sliced the air 2 feet above the ground. Hadrian leapt over it, and the tail glanced off the hillside, stabbing into a charred timber. A quick flick, and the several hundred-pound log flew into the night. Hadrian reached inside his tunic and drew Ulverstone from its sheath. He crouched like a knife fighter in a ring, up on the balls of his feet, waiting for the next attack. Once more, the Gilarabrin's tail came at him. This time it stabbed like a scorpion. Hadrian dove aside, and the long point sunk into the earth. He ran forward. The Gilarabrin snapped at Hadrian with its teeth. He was ready for that, expecting it, counting on it. He jumped aside at the last minute. It was so close, one tooth sliced through his tunic and gashed his shoulder. It was worth it. He was inches from the beast's face. With all his strength, Hadrian stabbed Royce's tiny dagger into the monster's great eye. The Gilarabrin screeched an awful cry that deafened Hadrian. It reared back, stomping its feet. The tiny blade pierced and cut a slice. It shook its head, perhaps as much in disbelief as in pain, and glared at Hadrian with its one remaining eye. Then it spat out words so laced with venom that Thomas didn't need to translate. The beast spread its wings and drew itself up into the air. Hadrian knew what was coming next, and cursed his own stupidity for having allowed the creature to move him so far from the pit. He could never make it there in time now. The Gilarabrin screeched and arched its back. There was a loud thwack. A wad of rope netting flew into the air like a ball. With small weights tied to the edges, which travelled faster than the centre, the net flew open like a giant windsock, enveloping the flapping beast even as it tried to take flight. Its wings tangled in the net, the Gilarabrin dropped to the hilltop, crushing down with a heavy thud, the impact throwing up bits of the manor house's stairway banister, which flew end over end before shattering in a cloud of ash. "It worked!" Tobias shouted, as much in shock as in triumph, from the far side of the hill. Hadrian saw his opportunity and, spinning around, charged the monster. As he did, he noticed Theron following him. "I told you to take Thrace and run!" Hadrian yelled.
"You looked like you needed help," Theron shouted back, "and I told Thrace to head for the well."
"What makes you think she'll listen to you any more than you listen to me?"
Hadrian reached where the Gilarabrin lay on its side, thrashing about wildly, and dove at its head. He found its open eye and attacked, stabbing repeatedly. With a terrible scream, the beast raked back with its legs, ripping the net open, and rolled to its feet again. Hadrian, so intent on blinding the beast, had stepped on the netting. When the monster rose, Hadrian's feet went out from under him. He fell flat on his back, the air knocked from his lungs. Blind, the beast resorted to lashing out with its tail, sweeping it across the ground. Caught trying to stand up, Hadrian was struck by the blunt force of the tail. Hadrian rolled and tumbled like a rag doll, sliding across the ash until he stopped in a patch of dirt where he lay unmoving. Freeing itself fully of the net, the beast sniffed the air and began moving toward the one who had caused it pain.
"No!"
Theron shouted, and charged. He ran for Hadrian, thinking he could drag him clear of the blind beast before it reached him. Only the beast was too fast, and reached Hadrian at the same time Theron did. Theron picked up a rock and drew forth the broken blade he still carried. He aimed for the exposed creature's side and, using the rock as a hammer, drove the metal home like a nail. This stopped the Gilarabrin from killing Hadrian, but the beast did not cry out as it had when Hadrian had stabbed it. Instead, it turned and laughed. Theron struck the blade with the rock again, forcing the metal deep, but still the beast did not cry out. It spoke to him, but Theron couldn't understand the words. Then, having little trouble guessing where the farmer stood, the Gilarabrin swiped at him with his claw. Theron didn't have the speed or agility that Hadrian had. Strong as he was for his age, his old body couldn't move clear of the blow in time. And the great nails of the beast stabbed into him like four swords.
Daddy!
Thrace screamed, running to him. She scrambled up the slope, crying as she came. From their blind, Tobias and the dwarf fired a rock at the Gilarabrin and managed to hit its tail. The beast spun and charged furiously in their direction. Falling to her hands and knees, Thrace crawled to Theron's side and found her father lying broken on the hill. His left arm lay twisted backward, his foot facing the wrong direction. His chest was soaked in dark blood, and his breath hitched as his body convulsed.
"Thrace,"
he managed to say weakly.
"Daddy!"
she cried as she cradled him in her arms.
"Thrace,"
he said again, gripping her with his remaining hand and pulling her close.
"I'm so..."
His eyes closed tightly in pain.
"I'm so proud of you."
"Oh, God, Daddy! No! No! No!"
she cried, shaking her head. She held him, squeezing as hard as she could, trying by the force of her arms to keep him with her. She would not let him go. She couldn't. He was all there was. She sobbed and wailed, clutching his shirt, kissing his cheek and forehead, and as she held him, she felt her father pass away into the night. Theron Wood died on the scorched ground in a pool of blood and dirt. As he did, the last tiny remnant of hope Thrace had held on to, the last foothold she had in the world, died with him. There was a darkness of night, a darkness of senses, and a darkness of spirit. Thrace felt herself drowning in all three. Her father was dead. Her light, her hope, her last dream, they had all died with his last breath. Nothing remained upon the world that it had not taken from her. It had killed her mother. It had killed her brother, his wife, and her nephew. It had killed Daniel Hall and Jesse Caswell. It had burned her village. It had killed her father. Thrace raised her head and looked across the hill at it. No one who had been attacked had ever lived. There were never any survivors. She stood and began to walk forward slowly. She reached into the robe and pulled out the sword that had remained hidden there. The beast found the catapult and shattered it. It turned and blindly began to search its way back down the hillside, sniffing. It didn't notice the young girl. The thick layer of ash that it had created quieted her steps.
"No, Thrace!"
Thomas shouted at her.
"Run away!"
The Gilarabrin paused and sniffed at the sound of the shout, sensing danger but unable to determine its source. It tried to look in the direction of the voice.
"No, Thrace, don't!"
Thrace ignored the cleric. She had passed beyond hearing, beyond seeing, beyond thinking. She was no longer on the hill. She was no longer in Dahlgren, but rather in a tunnel. A narrow tunnel that led inescapably to only one destination. It. It kills people. That's what it does. The beast sniffed the air. She could tell it was trying to find her. It was searching for the smell of fear it created in its victims. She had no fear. It had destroyed that too. Now she was invisible. Without hesitation, fear, question or regret, Thrace quietly walked up to the towering monster. She gripped the elven sword in both hands and raised it above her head. Putting the full weight of her small body into it, she thrust the broken sword into the Gilarabrin's body. She didn't have to put so much effort into it. The blade slipped in easily. The beast shrieked in mortal fear and confusion.
It turned, recoiling, but it was already too late. The sword penetrated all the way to the hilt. The essence that was de Gilarabrin, and the forces that bound it, shattered. With the snapping of the bonds that held it fast, the world reclaimed the energy in a sudden, violent outburst. The eruption of force threw Thrace and Thomas to the ground. The shockwave continued down the hill, radiating out in all directions, beyond the burnt desolation to the forest, launching flocks of birds into the night. Dazed, Thomas staggered to his feet and approached the small, slender figure of Thrace Wood at the center of a clear depression where the great Gilarabrin had once been. He walked forward in awe and fell prostrate on his knees before the girl. "Your Imperial Majesty," was all he said. Chapter 15. The Heir of Navron. The sun rose brightly over the Nidwalden River. The clouds had moved off, and by mid-morning the sky was clear and the air cooler than it had been. A light wind skimmed across the surface of the river, raising ripples, while the sun cast a brilliant gold face upon the water. A fish jumped above the surface and fell back with a plop. Overhead, birds sang morning songs, and cicadas droned. Royce and Arista stood on the bank of the river, wringing water out of their clothes. Ezra Harden waited. "Nice robe," the princess said. The wizard only smiled. Arista shivered as she looked out across the river. The trees on the far bank looked different than the ones on their side. A different species, perhaps. Arista thought they appeared prouder, straighter, with fewer lower branches and longer trunks. While the trees were impressive, there was no evidence of civilization. "How do we know they're over there?" Arista asked. "The elves?" Ezra Harden questioned. "I mean, no one has seen an elf." She glanced at Royce. "A pure-blood elf in centuries, right?" "They are there. Thousands of them by now, I should think. Tribes of the old names, with bloodlines that can be traced to the dawn of time. The Miralith, masters of the art. Asendwar, the hunters. Niliand, the crafters. Elohim, the architects. Umarlin, the spiritualists. Gwydrae, the shipwrights. And in Staria, the warriors. They're all still there, a congress of nations." "Do they have cities, like we do?" "Perhaps, but probably not like ours. There is a legend of a sacred place called Astromnodon. It is the holiest place in elven culture, at least that we humans know of. Astromnodon is said to be over there, deep in the forests. Some think it is their capital city and seat of their monarch. Others speculate it is the sacred grove where the first tree, the tree planted by Muriel herself, still grows and is cared for by the children of Faerol. No one knows for certain. No human is likely ever to know, as the elves do not suffer the trespasses of others."
"Really?"
The princess looked at the thief with a playful smirk. "Perhaps if I knew that before, I might have guessed Royce's heritage sooner." Royce ignored the comment and turned to the wizard. "Can I assume you'll not be returning to the village?" Ezra Harden shook his head. "I need to leave before Luis Guy and his pack of hounds track me down. Besides, I have an heir to talk to, and plans to make."
"Then this is goodbye. I need to get back."
Remember to keep silent about what you saw in the tower. Both of you.
Funny. I expected the heir and his guardian to be unknown farm boys from someplace, well, like this, I suppose. Someone I never heard of.